3, 2, 1, 0.
From the studios of WORQ in Wisconsin, this is the Stand Up for the Truth podcast. Today's issues, overlooked headlines, and biblical observations, equipping the remnant around the globe. Got your sword handy? This is Stand Up for the Truth.
It is Friday on the calendar, April 5, 2024. Fresh new podcast. Mary Danielson is here today, and she's her special guest is Headlines. At least you don't have to worry about trying to get a hold of someone.
That's right. Yes. All right. Yes, good morning. It is Friday, April the 5th. A quick shout out to my wonderful husband of 42 years. Happy birthday to you. And it is headline day, a chance to catch up with what the world is up to, mostly no good, I'm sure. But the reason that I do headline days is so that I can give background on some of the current issues, so that when you do watch the news, hopefully it's a little easier to understand things that are going on behind the scenes, how we got, you know, context. I guess just call it context. Say Iran, for example. There's so much going on with Iran. They are in the headlines all the time, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. And that would be very helpful to understand who they are and why they do what they do. Just a frame of reference for you today regarding prophecy, geopolitics, and more. So I'm going to open up with my scripture, Psalm 11, 4 to 7, and pray. And we're just going to jump right in. The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold. His eyelids test the sons of men. The Lord tests the righteous, but the wicked and the one who loves violence his soul hates. Upon the wicked he will rain coals, fire and brimstone, and a burning wind shall be the portion of their cup. For the Lord is righteous, he loves righteousness, his countenance beholds the upright. Would you pray with me today? Oh Lord, you are righteous in all your ways. Your judgments are true and altogether right, and we want to love what you love and hate what you hate. So we ask that you enable us to pursue truth with all our hearts. Show us, Lord, ways that we have leaned upon our own understanding and any ways that we've compromised truth for our own ends. You know our thoughts before we think them. Lord, you're acquainted with all our ways. So we ask that you cleanse our hearts and our minds that we might please you in all things. And Lord, that we might increase in wisdom day by day. Lord, you say that if we ask for wisdom, you give it liberally. And so we do ask for your wisdom about all things. In Jesus' name, amen. Just a quick shout out regarding the prophecy conference that's coming up in Appleton, April 26th, the 28th, and that is 3 weeks from today, so you can make your plans. Our speakers this year include Chris Quintana, David Fiorazzo, Don Stewart via live stream, Ed Urich, a former Calvary Chapel pastor, Gary Ka via live stream, Jeff Solwald, Pastor Jeff, in Madison. His program follows Stand Up for the Truth every day. Jim Fletcher, Rob Yardley, T.A. McMahon, Tommy Ice, and I will be doing a session as well. And you can go to ccappleton.org because registration is open. It's $35 per person for the entire weekend. A lot of great guests, and we are so looking forward to another conference. This is the spring conference. The fall one happens the weekend after Labor Day. So if you can't make this one, you can watch it live, or you can also try and catch us in person in September. Speaking of getting something else here towards the beginning, I want to talk about the eclipse, and this is going to be my last word on it. It's Monday, obviously. But I'm seeing ads run on TV. You know, it's branded. It has a name, The Great American Eclipse. And you can tune in to Nat Geo and Hulu, Disney, CNN, and NBC, and the self-proclaimed most trusted name in news, David Muir himself, stream this event live on Monday afternoon. And there's pictures of David Muir staring thoughtfully to the sky as they advertise this event. It's a little bit bizarre. And I'm starting to think that the reason that the church overhypes and over-sensationalizes this as much as the world is because somewhere in their thinking is embedded the idea that if it were to be an apocalyptic event or judgment of some sort, and if the church wasn't at the forefront of warning, that means that somehow the church is asleep at their post, or that there's some sort of fear of missing out here at work, or FOMO, as it's commonly called. But none of this is true or necessary, and we don't need to interpret every hiccup that the world encounters and, you know, stick it on some sort of grid of things that we are expecting. And I'm thinking they didn't learn a thing from the Blood Moon debacle. Now, if a person wants to go and they're traveling to see this, that's great. It's a great event. The heavens declare the glory of God. The hype is the problem, not going to see it. As I see the ads and the accompanying drama, it almost looks like some sort of Spirit of the Antichrist event, where the big names in news and culture, they're all looking at some celestial event in one accord, you know, telling everyone to watch and be amazed. It certainly has that vibe, that common experience, common American experience type of thing. But the best meme on social media this week said, "There's a total solar eclipse somewhere every 18 months, but only the ones over America are prophetic because, well, it's hashtag America." I did chuckle at that a little bit. Only because the self-orbit of Americans tends to be a little cringeworthy from time to time. It's a big old world out there. But when the church chimes in on all that, I don't know, it's even more awkward, and it can be very discrediting, and I wish people would not do that. It almost comes off as a little bit narcissistic from times. That's just my opinion on that. But my point being, what has eclipsed in America is sound doctrine being taught in sound churches, replaced by pop culture Christianity and left-wing theology. The Bible has been eclipsed. So I think we need to use the word as a verb, perhaps, and talk about the things that Americans should be paying more attention to. But again, if you're going to see this thing, enjoy. I'm sure there'll be a lot of people and a lot of crowds. And some of the strangest hype has to do with food shortages and National Guards being called out and all that sort of thing. And it's just, you know, the world goes dark for 8 hours every night or 12 or whatever, and people don't panic or collect food. So I don't know. It's a little bit strange. Some of the headlines here... Newsweek says Texas official warns people to stock up on food ahead of the eclipse. Another headline, stock up on food, water, and fuel ahead of the eclipse. Emergency officials warn. Warning of food shortage possible in New York during the eclipse. So that's just a little bit of the insanity. I don't know if you've come across any of that. But there are eclipses all over the world, all over the calendar. All right, I want to talk about Iran. And this is where background information might be helpful regarding things called proxies as an element of warfare. And we hear that all the time in the news, but we may not know what that means. Earlier this week, Israel launched an airstrike on a building next to Iran's embassy in Damascus that killed 7 members of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, including the top Iranian commander in Syria, Mohammad Reza Zahedi, and his deputy. He was reportedly responsible for the unit's operations in Syria and Lebanon and for the Iranian militias there and for ties with Hezbollah. So he had a very big job in the current Middle East. He oversaw all Iranian terrorist operations against Israel from Syria, Lebanon, and the Palestinian sphere. Now, you might recall back in 2020 when the Revolutionary Guard commander Soleimani was assassinated. That was a big deal as well because he's very, very powerful in Iran. If I were an Iranian general, I would be constantly watching over my shoulder and stay awake because as the world's number one exporter of terrorism and the leading military power consistently standing against Israel, escalation of hostilities over there is always a round-the-clock threat. And you might recall back in December, Israel delivered an airstrike in Syria that killed another Revolutionary Guard commander. We didn't hear a lot about that. And, of course, many Hamas leaders have been taken out over the course of the last 7 months. But since the 1979 revolution in Iran and their subsequent war with Iraq, Iran has built a network of proxies and militias that the Revolutionary Guard Corps gives training and financial support to in at least 6 countries. Those countries are Bahrain, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and the Palestinian territories. Again, these are Iranian proxies. Now, the U.S. has tried to rein them in with sanctions, But then Iran just turns around and gives them hundreds of millions of their own money. And now every administration since Reagan has tried the sanctions route with limited success, obviously. So when you hear about the Houthis and Hezbollah and Hamas, the world has Iran to thank for this type of warfare. It's called asymmetrical warfare because Iran is no match militarily to Israel or the U.S. Since all these proxies are involved in the current Israeli war with Hamas, it really is Iran who's at war with Israel. And I think we all know that. Although Iran claims that the proxies are acting independently, and I don't think any of us believes that. Hezbollah is the proxy that Iran has invested the most in. They are largely in the north. Now, for these reasons alone, Iran is the destabilizing force in the Mideast. They have spent $16 billion to prop up Assad in Syria. Now, they're both Shiites. All right, so keep that in mind. And they have trained and funded 100,000 troops in Syria. They are fracturing Iraq. Remember, Iran and Iraq were at war in the 90s. And now all of a sudden, they are fracturing. Iran is taking the lead in fracturing Iraq, which is half Sunni and half Shiite. And Iran has also sparked a revival of international jihadi networks that threaten many countries. So they really are the most destabilizing country at this time. Let's talk for a minute about the Sunni-Shiite aspect in all of this. It's an ancient religious divide that is centered around who Muhammad's successor should be. That is the pivot point here. Sunnis believe, and they are the majority in the Middle East, Muhammad never designated a successor to rule Islam. The Shiites, which is only 15% of Islam, say that the ruler of Islam must be a direct descendant of Muhammad. Today, the Hashemites of Jordan believe that they alone are direct descendants of Muhammad and can trace their royal lineage. So King Hussein would have been, and also King Abdullah is, currently in Jordan, is a direct descendant of Muhammad. And that's a freebie this morning. But never underestimate to what extent the Middle East Islamic hostilities are part of the ongoing war between Sunni and Shiite. That is, seems to be, from my research that I've done, always in the background of what goes on over there. And they've lived in relative peace side by side for, you know, until the last 100 years or so. It's not been the issue that it is now. Now, Netanyahu said this week that Iran is the head of the octopus. Now, I would more likely call it a serpent. But this short article confirms all that. I don't think this is a secret to anyone, but this is just a very short article with a quote. It says, Israel's killing of Zahedi, taking the fight to the Iranian head of the octopus. The Wall Street Journal termed the killing of Zahedi the first real price that Iran has paid for its proxy warfare in the Middle East. Quote, the Iranians don't love dying, but it's very easy for them to send others to die, unquote, then Education Minister Naftali Bennett said at the Herzliya conference in 2018. While we're shedding blood fighting their tentacles, the octopus's head is lounging in its chair enjoying itself, Bennett continued. The time had come, he declared, for Israel to aim at the head of the octopus and not the tentacles. Israel, according to foreign reports and Iranian accusations, did just that on Monday, killing Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps commander Mohammad Reza Zahedi in Damascus. Zahedi was the most senior Iranian official killed since the American strike on their Al-Quds Force commander Qasem Soleimani in 2020. So that was a big strike. And we don't really know what to expect. I'll get to that shortly here, what's going on there today. But here's an article. This is good. JNS, Jewish News Service, JNS. The Iranian regime is an existential threat to America. The only way to stop Iran's terrorist octopus is to deliver a crushing blow to the head. So he's reiterating what Naftali Bennett said and what Netanyahu believes. And he says, Americans must wake up to the existential threat posed by the Islamic Republic of Iran. U.S. democracy and Western democracy in general are under unprecedented attack by forces that are headed by the extremist fundamentalist regime in Tehran. It is a giant octopus that, through its numerous tentacles, is trying to undermine these democracies systematically. So it's not just the Middle East. And he goes on to say, within the U.S., Tehran uses clandestine means to undermine democratic values in several ways. Number one, it seeks to create a global axis of nations to subvert Western democracy and promote authoritarian ideologies. Number two, it is engaged in a systematic attack on U.S. strategic companies and infrastructure through cyber attacks. Thirdly, it is seeking to radicalize U.S. citizens through social media, religious centers, and similar avenues via groups with both direct and indirect links to Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Iran lobbies U.S. government bodies and Congress using groups connected to the regime in order to circumvent U.S. foreign and domestic policy. Its aim is to propagate the regime's extremist agenda. On occasion, such efforts involve those who seemingly oppose the regime. They have often succeeded in influencing U.S. foreign policy toward effectively appeasing the regime and giving it a valuable lifeline in times and funds. And this is the important point here. America's current policy towards the regime is appeasement. Well, there you have it. That's why the U.S. has been ineffective in stopping the regime's campaign of global destabilization, such as Iran's proxy Houthi terrorist attacks on global shipping. Continuation of such policies will only encourage the Houthis, Hamas, and Hezbollah in their terrorist activities, including on U.S. soil. The Iranian regime is also very adept at avoiding sanctions. We know that, as demonstrated by recent cases involving two UK clearing banks. And I'll conclude this article with this. Current U.S. policies will only put more American soldiers and citizens at risk. Even the U.S. proscription of the IRGC as a terror organization did not prevent U.S. soldiers from being killed by Revolutionary Guard proxies. So they are a tremendous threat, and Israel knows this very, very well. They are also inching ever closer to weapons-grade uranium all the while this is going on as well. What could possibly go wrong there? The Wall Street Journal said this a few weeks ago, and this is really interesting. When the current war happened, when it broke out in Israel on October 7th, I read that they were calling it the Al-Aqsa Flood, and I thought, and even up until recently, I thought, I mean, I understand. They're thinking about the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Temple Mount. I understand all that, but I was a little surprised by that. So I've been looking at it ever since. And this article is from the Wall Street Journal, How to Prevent an Iranian Caliphate. Now, an Iranian caliphate would be one in which the Islamic world would come under the total control of those who claim to be the descendants of Muhammad, a Shiite caliphate. There would be an Iranian government throughout the entire world of Islam led by a caliph or successor. Now, prophecy students might find this interesting. How to prevent an Iranian caliphate, Wall Street Journal. And it says Hamas styled its October 7th massacre as retaliation. Its name, Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, refers to the Israel Defense Forces' April 2023 intrusion into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound to tame riots and remove weapons stored there. That Israeli soldiers were present to protect the Temple Mount, Judaism's holiest site, is a potent symbol of lost sovereignty that Hamas purports to avenge. Yet Israel isn't the source of the conflict. It dates to March 3, 1924, 100 years ago, the end of the last major Islamic caliphate, which capped the forcible transfer of Islam's most sacred sites out of Ottoman hands. So the Ottoman Empire came to an end right around World War I, along with the downfall of the European monarchies, which made Europe to be made up of nation states once again. Okay. The shift to British Allied control over Mecca, Medina, and Al-Aqsa fulfilled European Empire's campaign to restore the caliphate to the Arabs by removing it from the Turks in Istanbul. The abrupt end, however, left open the question of who protects Muslims and their holy sites. The subtext of the Al-Aqsa Flood is that its current Arab guarantors, Jordan and Saudi, haven't done so. Now, Jordan, Shiite, Saudi, Sunni. Very interesting. Hamas's assault violated Israel's borders, reflecting its agenda of reverting to pre-European frontiers. Similarly, when ISIS crashed through the Syrian border a decade ago, it did to restore al-Sham, an area consisting of historical Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, parts of Egypt and Turkey, erasing the nation states it considers to be colonialist slave names. So there's a lot of this part of the reason why there's so much destabilization. Things are changing. Do you remember the Arab Spring back in 2011? I'm still not sure what that actually, you know, accomplished. I don't know if any of us know for sure, but I think it's an ongoing thing. The fruit of that is still part of this destabilization. It goes on to say the missing caliphate has presented an opportunity for Iran, whose revolution restored religious rule in 1979. The mullahs proclaimed their desire to reconquer Jerusalem by holding its first annual Al-Quds Day, the Arabic name for the city, in rejection of the budding peace between Israel and Egypt. The Saudis were similarly threatened when insurgents occupied the Great Mosque of Mecca for 2 weeks that year. But Tehran took a backseat to the regional Sunni bloc when Hamas suicide bombers attacked Israeli citizens in the 2000 Al-Aqsa Intifada. They weren't seen to be acting at Iran's behest. As Sunni regimes have gradually normalized relations with Israel, the dynamic has changed. It is so hard to keep up with all the change that's going on over there. The October 25th photograph of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and Hezbollah leaders meeting under the portraits of Iranian ayatollahs is a striking sign of the times. The activation of Iran's alliances beyond Hezbollah and the Houthis complete an arc of cross-sectarian influence stretching from Syria to Yemen. Whether this amounts to Iran's caliphal moment or a desperate effort against a turning regional tide is unclear. On the one hand, the Saudis are on the verge of becoming the seventh Arab state to recognize Israel. On the other, Iran's spoiler role in Middle East peace talks reflects geopolitical shifts that eliminated many of its rivals of the past two decades. Iraq lurched from Sunni-led counterweight into Iran's column, while Afghanistan came under Islamic rule. And it's no wonder things are an absolute mess over there. Well, this is where it gets interesting. The Gaza War is a reminder that the Europeans left behind an unstable status quo a century ago. Minus a Sunni consensus, Iran is making an indirect power play. Iran's weakness is also a strength. As non-Arab Shiite Muslims, Iran's leaders can't trace their ancestry to the Prophet Muhammad's tribe, as can Jordan and Morocco's monarchs. And ISIS's Baghdadi have claimed. The dynamic, here's the solution, the Wall Street Journal suggests. The dynamic might be resolved with a Vatican City-style solution for Al-Aqsa. Now, Al-Aqsa is the mosque on the Temple Mount. The Dome of the Rock is a shrine to where supposedly Muhammad ascended into heaven. Al-Aqsa is a mosque that holds 5,000 people at a time. And the Palestinians believe that Israel is going to launch an aggression against that mosque. Okay, so let me start this paragraph over. The dynamic might be resolved with a Vatican City-style solution for Al-Aqsa. Those responsible for overseeing the complex would include Saudi Arabia and Jordan, but also Muslims from Turkey, Indonesia, Egypt, Morocco, Algeria, Pakistan, Nigeria, and Muslim minority countries. Free from Western government interference, the arrangement would have to retain Jewish rights to visit and pray at the Temple Mount. Israeli soldiers' presence could be diffused by cooperative patrols alongside the soldiers of countries with which the Jewish state has built thick relations. Now, this is interesting because I think we've been wondering, at some point, this is going to have to be addressed. At some point, the fact that the October 7th attack by Hamas would even be suggested to be because of the Al-Aqsa Mosque is still, I'm not so sure exactly how that plays in. But apparently the Wall Street Journal is convinced that this is a part of it and that something is going to have to be done. And we know that something will be done. It doesn't really matter how they approach it. But would Iran be opposed or for this comprehensive deal? Because it would probably seal the Hashemite and Saudi oversight of Al-Aqsa. But would it unite the Islamic world over something like that? We don't know. Very interesting that the Wall Street Journal would even go there. So you can maybe look that up for yourself if you're interested for more information. Currently, let's bring it up to today. Keep an eye on Israel in the event that Iran retaliates, because leaves have been canceled, reserves have been called up. And I find that Israel is definitely going to be aware of the potential for a huge escalation of what's going on over there. This article, IDF cancels leave for all combat units in wake of Iranian threats. And it says, With Iran threatening revenge for the assassination of one of its top commanders on Monday, the Israeli military took the unusual step on Thursday of canceling leave for all combat units. The IDF is at war, and the deployment of forces is under continuous assessment according to requirements, the Army said in a statement. The notice comes after the Army on Wednesday decided to increase manpower and call up reserve soldiers to the IDF Aerial Defense Array. Meanwhile, there have been reports of wide-scale GPS disruptions in Israel, a defensive measure attributed to the IDF as a means to confuse enemy aerial attacks, though the military has remained silent on the matter. According to Israeli assessments, Iran could attempt to attack Israel through one of its terror proxies, whether it be in Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthis in Yemen, or militia forces in Syria. Israel said it attacked terror targets in southern Lebanon on Wednesday night. IAF fighter jets struck Hezbollah launch posts. And on February 4th, military spokesman Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari revealed that the IAF has attacked more than 50 targets belonging to Hezbollah and other Iran-backed terrorist groups in Syria since October the 7th. This morning, another article just came up. Israel warns of massive regional war if directly attacked. And it says, with Israel's embassies around the world on heightened state of alert, extra IDF reservists called up, and home and weekend leave for all troops having been abruptly canceled Thursday, the Israeli population is anxiously awaiting a response, with some reports saying residents are already seeking the safety of bomb shelters. They've been through an awful lot, and this is just an added threat and level of anxiety that Israel is going through right now, so we need to pray for Israel. It says Iran has vowed that vengeance is coming soon for the Monday Israeli airstrike on its embassy in Damascus. Most pundits believe that this will take the form of ballistic missiles raining down on Israeli cities. But Israeli leader Netanyahu is reportedly vowing that if the Islamic Republic launches missiles from its soil, it will ensure a strong response from Israel, of which I have no doubt. Israeli officials have told Axios late in the day that such an act would take the current conflict to another level, which most certainly would involve a direct Israel-Iran war, and thus the eruption of a broader regional conflict. And they add the following observations. Number one, Iranian proxies in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Gaza have attacked Israel, but there hasn't been an attack from Iranian soil. And secondly, a direct Iranian strike on Israel would be unprecedented and would lead to a regional war in the Middle East. Netanyahu informed his security cabinet Thursday that Israel's forces have already been engaged with Iran both directly and via proxies, and therefore Israel is operating against Iran and its proxies both defensively and offensively. A statement issued by the Prime Minister's office laid out, "We will know how to defend ourselves and will operate according to the basic principle of whoever is harming or planning to harm us, we will harm him." The White House has meanwhile issued a statement shortly after Biden and Netanyahu discussed the crisis in Gaza, saying President Biden made clear that the U.S. strongly supports Israel in the face of those Iranian threats. The CIA has warned Israel to expect an attack within the next 48 hours. We don't know. We don't know what to expect. We don't know the future that way. But again, pray for Israel in all these things. And you think to yourself, what has held it all together this long anyway? Well, the Lord has. And the Holy Spirit is the restraining force that keeps things together in the Middle East until God says this or that is going to happen. And it'll be his perfect time. And it'll be based on his righteousness and his justice. And as we get closer to entering that time of Jacob's trouble, to bring Israel back to the Lord and recognize their Messiah. So that's the Middle East update. I have a lot more topics in the second half. We're going to talk about Florida's the Supreme Court and the abortion ruling this week. We're going to talk about our food supply. There's some pretty weird stuff out there. So I'm going to take a two-minute break, and then I'm going to come back with a lot more updates, things that are going on that I think are really valuable for us to know. We've had a lot of podcast guests since 2010. StandForTheTruth.com has a list of all the popular guests. Click on guests and scroll through, see what you missed, what you might want to catch up on. So I'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with me.
Your prayers and ongoing financial support keep our Truth at Any Cost mission strong. StandUpForTheTruth.com.
Welcome back to Stand Up For The Truth for Friday, April 5th. So much going on in the news. It's difficult to say that we are catching up on anything, but there's been a lot of news this week. Abortion news this week. Florida Supreme Court allows one of the nation's strictest abortion bans to take effect. So Florida Supreme Court allows one of nation's strictest abortion bans to take effect. The Washington Post says the high court simultaneously ruled that a referendum enshrining abortion rights can go on the November ballot. So nothing is set, but it's good news for today. Every day that saves lives is good news. Florida's conservative Supreme Court ruled Monday that the state's constitution does not protect abortion rights, allowing one of the country's strictest and most far-reaching bans to take effect May 1st. But in a separate decision, the High Court also ruled that an amendment to enshrine abortion rights in the state's constitution can go on the ballot for a vote that could undo the ban in a matter of months. And I tell you about this because I think this is really worth our prayer. Together, the two rulings will ensure that abortion is a major issue in Florida during the presidential election, with Floridians experiencing the realities of a six-week abortion ban for 6 months before they have the opportunity to cast a vote on the issue. The Post says, quote, today's rulings prove exactly what is at stake at the ballot box, said Nikki Fried, the chair of the Florida Democratic Party. Florida voters understand that voting yes on Amendment 4 in November is our last line of defense, end quote. The abortion ban ruling will have a dual effect on abortion access in Florida. While the case centered on the constitutionality of the state's existing 15-week ban, which took effect in the summer of 22, the court's ruling will also trigger a far stricter law passed last spring that will outlaw abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy before many people know they're pregnant. Florida's six-week ban was written to take effect only if the Supreme Court greenlit the 15-week law. The six-week ban in Florida, which includes exceptions for rape, incest, fatal anomalies, and medical emergencies, will all but eliminate abortion access in the South while further straining abortion clinics elsewhere across America. There is nowhere in the Southeast that can absorb Florida's patient base. It's simply not possible, said Lauren Brenzel, the campaign director of Floridians Protecting Freedom, a campaign dedicated to putting abortion on the ballot in the state in 2024. That is simply an unmanageable volume of patients to try to offset to another state. The abortion ban ruling significantly narrows the scope of a provision in the Florida Constitution that protects the right to privacy, added by voters in 1980 and being interpreted by courts as a safeguard against abortion restrictions. Pro-lifers are saying, I'm ecstatic. Having spent a lifetime of work leading up to this moment, said John Stemberger, a leading abortion opponent in Florida and the president of Liberty Counsel Action, a conservative advocacy group. He says, we've been arguing for 35 years that the privacy clause was about informational privacy and was never intended by the people to create a fundamental right to abortion. So there is definitely a snapshot of the conflicting forces in Florida and really across the nation since Roe v. Wade fell in 2022. Florida's high court has grown significantly more conservative under DeSantis. No surprises there. And surveys show that most of the state's voters oppose bans on abortion during the very early stages of pregnancy. So I tell you that so you can pray. And I think that it's going to be an issue on the ballot in the fall, I think, regardless of where a person lives. Let's talk about food. It amazes me, really, how much food is grown and produced on Earth to feed how many billions of people? And I tend to look at it as God's providing from his abundance, creating what we need to grow, assimilating what we need to eat and thrive. God made dirt, right? And that's how we can grow. And I'm saying that because there's another piece that's coming up a little bit later about countries that think dirt is the problem when it comes to climate change, which is it just gets more absurd by the day. But mankind has also been tinkering with our food for decades. The dawn of processed and heavily sugared food made from soy and corn, I think we can say, has had questionable effects on our health, especially here in the U.S., where the government allows a lot of processing and questionable additives that other countries don't allow, specifically Europe. Then came genetically modified or GMO foods, whose effects on humans I don't think is fully known. So there's a war that we have to fight to determine what is safe to eat for optimal health. And we as a people are getting sicker by the week and not making great choices. But a lot of that in these times that are difficult financially comes down to what we can afford. These are financial decisions being made of what we can eat and what we can feed our families. Well, along comes this world of technocracy, the WEF, the global warming crowd, and they just outright want to control our land, our farms, animals, energy, which is, of course, not going to end well, but it's going to result in famines, poverty, and total control over the population and the world, which is the end game, through poison or starvation, whatever works for their global agenda. This article, Tennessee lawmakers pass bill targeting mRNA vaccines in food. And this isn't really a new story necessarily, but Tennessee is saying, oh, no, not here. Following concerns over research to embed vaccines in produce, the Tennessee Senate has passed a bill which would require any food containing vaccines or vaccine materials to be labeled as pharmaceutical drugs. Well, it's a step. The bill, HB 1894, was passed by the Senate in a 23-6 vote on March 28th after the State House passed it, 73-22 on March 4th. The bill comes in response to a University of California Riverside research project looking into whether mRNA, which targets pathogens and could be implanted into edible plants, which would then be consumed. The research was funded by a $500,000 grant from the National Science Foundation. It says you would have to get a prescription for that to make sure we know how much of the lettuce you have to eat based off of your body type so we don't under-vaccinate you, which leads to the possibility of the efficacy of the drug being compromised, or we overdose you based on how much lettuce is eaten. I have a hard time keeping a straight face on this, but this is really going on. We are testing this approach with spinach and lettuce and have long-term goals of people growing it in their own gardens. Farmers could eventually grow entire fields of it. A single plant would produce enough mRNA to vaccinate a single person. Another researcher, Nicole Steinmetz, said in the same release that they plan to use nanoparticles or plant viruses for gene delivery to plants. During the debate on the Tennessee Senate floor, some lawmakers questioned the need for the bill. Does the sponsor know of any instances of there being offered in the state of Tennessee that contains vaccines in some kind of retail or public forum? One representative hit back, highlighting in February that a Kentucky company has already been infecting growing tobacco plants with genetically modified coronavirus to see if it can produce antibodies for a potential vaccine, adding that the company can already do this right now. It is hard to keep a straight face with that, but I think the danger is real. Jeff Childers, Coffee and COVID, says, it sounds totally insane to even need a law like this, but the article cited at least three different efforts to include vaccines in food, and then he remarks on the $500,000 grant. Second, according to the article, Kentucky Bioprocessing LLC has announced it already is infecting growing tobacco plants. Third, Representative Kapicki said the U.S. Congress had recently taken up a bill to allow vaccines to be dispersed through the nation's food supply. If all these plant vaccine schemes seem to you like the dumbest idea yet in a long series of dumb vaccine ideas, you'd be right. Apart from vaccinating people without their knowledge, which proponents deny is a reason, what is the use case justifying the cost and effort of safely and effectively modifying the genes of sweet potatoes and broccoli to vaccinate people for COVID, which people don't even want anymore? And he says, why can't we leave our poor vegetables alone? Well, it's not just dumb, it's nefarious. And keep an eye on how that is going to go. Patrick Wood has an interesting article, because people are striking back about farmland disappearing and so many ways that probably Agenda 2030 would figure in here, of course, on what farmers are told they can and cannot do anywhere. Well, European farmers have had it. And Patrick Wood has an article, The Fury of Europe's Farmers Shocks EU Technocrats. That's That's disturbing, the fact that it's shocking to them. But here's Patrick's intro. The continent-wide fury of EU farmers is blazing a trail straight to the heart of technocracy, namely the green agenda, net zero, and the war on energy and food. The late Rosa Quire warned Europe between 2010 and 2015 about, quote, the blueprint, the comprehensive plan for the 21st century to inventory and control all land, all water, all plants, minerals, animals, construction, all means of production, all energy, all law enforcement, all healthcare, food, education, information, and all human beings in the world. The farmers got it and are now fighting for their lives and livelihoods. Technocrats spin out these suicidal policies using their oracle of pseudoscience as their god. However, it is no god, but rather base scientism. These are those whose intent is to destroy the earth. Will we stop them before it's too late? And Patrick says, Europe's farmers are rising up, and the elites are terrified. In France, farmers recently staged a four-day siege of Paris, blocking major roads around the French capital. In January, thousands of tractors descended on Berlin in Germany, lining the streets leading up to the Brandenburg Gate. In Brussels, farmers have gathered from all over Europe to demonstrate against the EU and pelt the European Parliament with eggs. In the Netherlands, tractors have caused the longest traffic jam in the nation's history as part of a years-long battle between farmers and the government. The farmers' revolt is now truly Europe-wide. From Portugal to Poland, from Ireland to Italy, almost every EU country has been rocked by protests. What is driving this populist uprising? What do they want? Farmers in each country have their own specific grievances, of course, but there's a common root to their anger. What connects them is the European Union's green agenda, which has been imposed on agriculture from on high. It has made farmers' lives a misery, sacrificing their livelihoods at the altar of climate alarmism. Bureaucrats who have no idea how farmers work and live have essentially been condemning farms, many of them run by families for generations, to oblivion, all at the stroke of a regulator's pen, and the farmers are not putting up with it anymore. Yay. The first stirrings of revolt began in 2019 in the Netherlands with the so-called nitrogen crisis. The Dutch Supreme Court ruled that the government was failing to cut nitrogen pollution to EU-approved levels. Of course, there's your Brussels bureaucrats again. In response, the Dutch government promised drastic measures to cut nitrogen emissions. In all but name, it declared war on its nation's farmers. Suddenly, the government had turned against one of its most important and impressive sectors. The Netherlands, despite its small size, is the second largest exporter of food in the entire world. Did not know that. Thanks to the world-beating efficiency of its farms. And nitrogen is intrinsic to this efficiency. Fertilizers are rich in nitrogen, and farmers need fertilizers to maximize their cropped yields. It is the inevitable byproduct of animal farming. And it talks about, goes into great detail about that. The Netherlands has over 4 million cows, 13 million pigs, and 104 million chickens. That's a lot of nitrogen. So the crackdown on nitrogen emissions is going to hit the farmers hard. Even so, the Dutch government's proposals went even further than anyone could have imagined. It said it would buy out thousands of the most polluting farms and shut them down. Other farms would have to cull a proportion of their animals, which would mean slaughtering half of all the livestock in the Netherlands. This is an unthinkable act of national economic self-harm. Thus, the farmers' revolt was born. Huge protests erupted in 2019. After a brief hiatus during the COVID pandemic, it came roaring back in 21 and 22. Dutch farmers have blocked roads, railways, canals, bridges, etc. And this is done with the approval and encouragement of the EU, and there's worse to come in the Netherlands and beyond. So you get the general idea. Under the EU's so-called Green Deal, every EU member state has to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2050. Net zero means no farms. And the punishing green policies don't stop there either. The farm-to-fork strategy announced in 2020 calls for 10% of farmland to be set aside for non-agricultural use. A quarter of EU farms must become organic, and fertilizer must fall by 20%. I don't know who makes this stuff up. It's a very long article. It says the fury of the farmers is impossible to ignore. The usually tin-eared elites across Europe have been forced to listen and respond. So something's happening, and of course, like I said earlier, we have, God has given us the dirt that we need to grow what we need to live, no matter how many people are on earth. And there is an article here, I hope I can find it quickly, about Australia. They're saying that dirt is the problem. I hope I can find it. I'm trying to scroll down here. You get the general idea. Australia believes they have drank the Kool-Aid of this green stuff, the green Kool-Aid. Oh, here it is. Australians are facing a new climate criminal, and that criminal is soil. This is from the expose. A study published in the Nature Portfolio Journal warns that Australia's soil is becoming a net carbon emitter and threatens to ruin the country's net zero goals. Do they hear themselves? They claim that over the next 80 years, Australian soil will release up to 100 megatons of CO2 into the atmosphere. Excuse me. Dirt is now the major threat to the future of planet Earth. Gee, I thought planet Earth was made up of dirt. I reckon some greenie counselor is going to try and make you concrete everything now that they know dirt is a climate criminal. So Australia needs to fight back on this nonsense. But I don't know if they will. I don't know if the people have the will. Europe certainly seems to have the will to put up a fight. Not sure about Australia. They had some of the strictest COVID rules of any country. So we'll see about that. Europe is wargaming. Got time for a couple more headlines. Europe is wargaming a food crisis. So clearly they seem to understand what it is they're doing. A group of people came together last month to tackle the worst case scenario in one of the best fed regions in the world. Of course, it's always in the best fed regions in the world. The combined forces of El Nino and La Nina have crippled Latin American soy output. Ukrainian and Russian grain farmers have gone to war. Indonesia has banned shipments of palm oil to Europe while China is hungry for crops. The Mediterranean region is getting more like a desert. The year is 2024. Food shortage in Europe? The only question is when, but they don't listen, says an unidentified voice in a video broadcast. The audience listens. The dramatic collision of events, of course, hasn't yet come to pass, but over 2 days in central Brussels last month, some 60 European Union and government officials, food security experts, industry representatives, and a few journalists gathered to confront the possibility of something barely on the radar a few years ago, which is a full-blown food crisis that they created. Can I add that? The group sat down in a refurbished Art Deco shell building to simulate what might happen and help design policies aimed at prevention and response. A few streets away, farmers were stepping up to their protests against the EU, disrupting supplies to supermarkets as if to sharpen the focus of the participants. The plush co-working space was hardly a bunker or secure basement in a war zone, but the video image full of drought, flood, and civil unrest to the pounding beat of ominous music created a sense of urgency. We can expect a level of chaos, a systems modeler and game designer who has worked with the UN said. You may be confused at times and not have enough information. There will be time travel. So in other words, they've made a video, they've made this documentary talking about that we are headed for a global food crisis. To watch one of the best fed regions in the world stress test its food system underscores a growing level of alarm among governments over securing supplies for their populations. In the space of 4 years, multiple shocks have shaken up the way food is grown, distributed, and consumed. The COVID pandemic, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and disruptions on key shipping routes have disturbed supply chains and sent prices soaring, and I think we can all agree on that. Erratic and extreme weather now regularly disturbs farming. Against that backdrop, officials are no longer asking when a food crisis may arrive, but rather how many crises they can deal with at once. So they're worried about harvest failures, the prices of animal feed, and all the other things that we've talked about here, just being a perfect storm and affecting food. And, of course, the prices of groceries are ridiculous. And how much of it is orchestrated? Well, most of it. And one more here. This is Leo Holman. Liberal state declares war on small farmers and homesteaders. War on food is spreading in the U.S. through land use restrictions, geoengineering, and waves of propaganda. And then he says, remember, it's really all about depopulation, which the WEF has been warning us about owning nothing and being happy Well, eating nothing and being happy is probably next. Small farmers are under attack in Oregon, which has begun shutting down family farms throughout the state under the guise of water conservation and groundwater protection. And you get the idea. It is just all about global control. And it's not going to end with any of that. But food, now that hits us all where we live, everyone across the entire planet. Australian Senate approves digital ID. America is next. Digital IDs were just approved in the Australian Senate and will be coming soon to the U.S. as part of the World Economic Forum-backed global technocratic gulag, complete with central bank currencies and social credit scores for all. The bill, which passed through the Australian Senate on March 27th, is putting in place the legislative framework for the phased expansion of Australian government's digital ID system to include state and territory government services and the private sector. The government made a case for what life would be like with and without a digital ID. And here's their little scenario. Amir and his family lost their house during a recent flood, and he needs to prove who he is to access government support. Without a digital ID, Amir will find it more difficult to prove his identity, given his ID documents were lost in the flood. With a digital ID, Amir has already set up a digital ID before he lost his documents in the flood. With his mobile and internet connection, he can log on online and verify his ID within 5 minutes to access his cash claim. What the Australian government and all totalitarian evildoers neglect to mention is the complete loss of privacy and individual sovereignty that digitization brings. Among other concerns, digital IDs are part of the architecture of tyranny. They have been pushed for many years by Bill Gates, the Rockefeller dynasty, and other known subversives pushing the overthrow of human liberty and prosperity. Coming to a nation near you, I think America's digital ID, I don't know, I haven't heard a lot lately. I know they were shooting for 2030, and then it became 2025. And it's interesting enough that this particular profile of Amir and his family, I've been saying for years that if the rapture happens, that is how they will push the mark. And those already who have a digital ID, they'll be able to access, they'll be able to buy and sell. But if you don't, they won't know who's here. They won't know who's been left behind. And this will be on a far greater scale than anything like Amir's local flood portends. This will be a worldwide scale. And not that they know anything about that, but I've always said that this digital ID, that the mark itself would be very, very important and a big sell if the rapture happens. Let's see. I got time probably for one more here. This is from Bloomberg Technology by Drake Bennett. And he's talking about the earthquake that struck Taiwan on Wednesday. And if you've seen some of the pictures, there are buildings at some pretty precarious angles. And I know that they are in a quake hot zone. I'm a little surprised that any buildings would be that easily pushed off their foundation. But this was a 7.5. Some are saying 7.7. So it was very, very powerful. But he says, the earthquake that struck Taiwan on Wednesday morning killed at least 10 people and injured more than 1,000. Considering that it was, well, he says a 7.4. This is the strongest quake the island has suffered in decades. Things could have been far worse. Taiwan has built defense mechanism against the earthquakes that are a fact of life there. Strict building codes minimize the damage. Search and rescue teams and aid volunteers are well-trained, and citizens know the drill. As news stories were quick to point out, the quake also was a reminder of just how much the global economy relies on Taiwan. The small island produces somewhere between 80 to 90% of the world's advanced semiconductors. I did not know that. Just one company, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, TSMC, accounts for half of the global supply. Taiwan's chip production facilities, built like everything else there with earthquakes in mind, were little affected by the quake, but the greater threat to the self-governing island and its chip industry isn't seismic, it's China, a massive nuclear-armed and increasingly aggressive neighbor that denies Taiwan's right to be independent. The 2022 book Chip War, The Fight for the World's Most Critical Technology, told the story of how global chip manufacturing came to be so concentrated in such a precarious place. The author of that book, Chris Millers, has said that the effects of a catastrophic event knocking out TSMC would be akin to the Great Depression. To address this threat, policymakers in the U.S. and elsewhere are trying to figure out how to make advanced chips in more places, but that's easier said than done, and our current administration is committed to putting billions of dollars, throwing it at Intel to see what happens. But that is another little precarious slide when it comes to the economic status of the global economy, which the Bible says we will have in the last days. So that is my headlines. Those are my headlines for this particular week. Who knows? Next week might be something completely different. We live in a precarious world. So thanks for joining me. We are listener supported, and we so appreciate you. If you have any thoughts on any of this, contact me at comments at standupforthetruth.com. Monday, Andy Woods replay. Tuesday, Bill Perkins. Thursday, John Hopper, and then J.B. Hickson on Friday. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. Have a great weekend.